Okay, so back in high school, there was this girl, Melissa, I used to kick it with, right? Most days after school, we'd hang, read books, watch movies, do homework. Really, that's what we did, because I was shy like that. But that was okay, because we had prom coming up. I knew it was going to be awesome, because with a beauty like Melissa on my arm, what could go wrong, right? I went through the whole checklist. Had to get a cummerbund, a tux, dinner reservations. I couldn't swing a limo, but I asked my buddy's dad if I could borrow his caddy. And at first, he wasn't having it. Please, Mr. Jenkins, please, I'll bring it back better than I took it. And finally, the day before the prom, he relented. And I was so happy, I told her, hey, he said we could ride the caddy to the prom. You never asked me to the prom. I'm going with Mikey Chevalier. Oh. And there I was, with the car, with the tux, the dinner reservations, everything I needed for prom except someone to go with. Tired of being a loser. Had to think of something. I call my buddy at a different school. He hears me out, and then he says, I'm sorry for your stupidity, but I don't know what you want me to do about it. Well, I need you to ask your sister to go with me. For me.
Ask her yourself.
But I barely know her.
Then why you want to take her to the prom? She ain't even like you.
Come on. He's my buddy. So he does it. And I already know it's going to suck. Taking my buddy's little sister to the prom. I just got to make sure she doesn't talk to any of my friends. But I am going to the prom. I am. So I'll go pick her up. And she comes down to the door. And she's beautiful. Like, I knew she was cute, but she's beautiful. And when she gets in the car, she's quiet for a moment. And she turns to me and says, thanks for asking me. Your brother says you don't even like me. And she squeals, he's such a liar. And we bond over what a jerk her brother is and laugh the whole way to the country club. And before we walk through the wall of roses, she grabs a hold of my arm and whispers, we have to enter properly. And we enter properly with many oohs and ahs. I try to get her something to drink. She wants to dance, so we go to the dance floor and she's doing all these steps and I try to keep up and we're laughing and spinning and it's awesome. We have the best time. And that night, I drop her off at her place. And she says, thanks. Kisses me on the cheek and runs inside. Wow. The next week, I see my friend Melissa again. And like normal, we kick it. Read books, watch movies. And then she says, almost casual, but not really casual. I'm gonna be kind of busy the rest of the weekend. And then I say, almost casual, but not really casual. Yeah, me too. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, the B Team. Amazing stories from real people for whom their first choice was not available. My name is Glenn Washington. Make sure the parking brake is disengaged, because this is Snap Judgment. Now then, if you are risk adverse or anxiety prone, you'll be able to relate to this next story. Our own Anna Sussman takes us back to the summer when she was only 11 years old.
Camp Okiwa every summer as a kid. 10 cabins arranged in a circle in a tiny cutout of cedar forest. Each June, 100 boys and girls would pile into bunk beds and sleep to the sounds of peeping frogs from the swamp on the edge of camp. We were free from the shackles of winter and school and parents. But something about that freedom, and the cabins made of screen, the boundless expanse of forest, the absence of teachers or parents, terrified me. At camp, we had our own kid families. There was a 9-year-old girl named Danelle who followed me around and sat next to me at the bonfire. At camp, an 11-year-old becomes a full-on mother to a 9-year-old. I'd hug her before bed. I helped teach her how to swim. Other kids would come and tell me when Danelle was crying, because Danelle was scared of everything at camp. Swimming in the creek, sleeping in the dark. Danelle didn't know that I was scared of everything, too. I was the only kid that brought their own first aid kit to camp. And I refused to go to sleep at bedtime until I went around and shouted down the toilet of each outhouse to make sure a kid hadn't fallen in. On canoe trips, I had to personally make sure that every kid's life jacket was strapped on correctly and snugly. The other campers seemed to walk around completely certain that we weren't all going to die in some freak accident. Danelle and I liked the quiet activities. We'd sit on the dock singing songs while a counselor played guitar, or go to the dining hall for bracelet making. There was one activity that I lived in fear of. It was called Swamp Stomp.
Swamp Stomp.
Swamp Stomp.
Two counselors would lead a group of squealing kids into the swamp at the edge of camp. They would wade into the mud until it seeped over their shoes and waistbands. They'd throw handfuls of mud into the air, rub leafy muck into their hair and clothes. Then they would always parade back through the camp, mud in their ears and pockets. They'd grin with mud in their teeth, victorious and free. I would look up from my bracelet making, in awe and horror. Of course, I thought it was reckless to bring children stomping into this unknown morass. I worried a kid would get lost in the mud, or get dragged down by some invisible hand. There were just so many unknowns in the sucking muck. I wanted the counselors to keep us safe, and Swamp Stomp seemed very unsafe. But I also knew enough to worry about my own worrying. I sat on the edge of the pool during midnight swim, while other kids splashed around in the dark water. I never climbed the rock wall, never got to ring the bell at the top. And then, when Danelle refused to sign up for an overnight hiking trip, I knew she'd be missing out. And I knew she probably watched me back away from just about everything. So one afternoon, I hopped onto the dock where Danelle was sitting. "Hey, I signed up for Swamp Stomp tomorrow. We should totally do it together." I didn't look at her when I said it, like it was no big deal. "You're definitely doing it," said Danelle. "Yeah, I'm definitely doing it." Danelle walked over to the camp bulletin board and wrote down her name on the last open line under Swamp Stomp. Then she looked at me. "I'm definitely doing it too." That night in my anxiety, I inventoried my first aid kit in bed, twice. Then I lie awake listening to the frogs in the swamp. I didn't eat breakfast the next morning, and then it was time. We walked to the edge of the swamp. The other kids lifted their knees high and swung their arms, plowing into the swamp like they were running into the ocean. Danelle and I hung back. I put one foot forward and leaned in. The mud crested my sneakers. My socks got wet. I stepped further and the swamp sucked at my shins. The other kids were already throwing mud balls. Then I saw Danelle. She was all in, painting her face with lines of mud and laughing. I stuck my fingers in the mud and began to let go just a bit. Then I climbed on a tree root and dropped into the swamp on my knees. I laughed. Danelle was waist deep, dragging her tiny body through the muck. What happened next is hazy. I watched as Danelle moved unnaturally. She jerked her back into an arch, but her lower body was frozen. Her scream suddenly had a sharp edge. Then the other kids were screaming, and I saw a cloud of bees form around Danelle. She had stomped on a beehive. Each kid realized what had happened one by one as they got stung or saw someone else get stung. One boy's hands flew to his face. A girl grabbed his shoulder. Everyone swatted and ducked, but no one could run. We were stuck. A counselor pushed hard toward Danelle through the swamp in slow motion. She lifted her in a fireman's carry and trudged to the edge of the swamp, and then once they were clear of the mud, sprinted back to camp. Danelle was allergic to bees. In my mind, I saw the EpiPen in the nurse's cabinet, the piece of masking tape on it, and the marker writing that said Danelle Patterson. By the time I got back to camp, they were closing the ambulance doors. I stood in the middle of the circle of cabins, filthy and shaking. I killed Danelle. Someone took me to the showers. They told me, "We don't know anything yet." I climbed into bed that night and I felt fuzzy and empty. From my screened-in cabin, I made a promise to the dark world that I wouldn't do anything unsafe again. Anything. The next morning at breakfast, a crowd had formed around one of the tables. Danelle was at the center, beaming and pointing out each one of her 20-something welts. She hugged me and then tucked into her cereal. "That was so crazy, right?" she said, and I watched her happily chewing. A few days later, she was at the bulletin board, writing her name down for Swamp Stomp. She handed me the pen. "You coming?"
Careful out there, snappers. Never, ever go outside. That piece was produced by our own Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Now, today on Snap Judgment, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Sarah Barron signed up to teach a writing class knowing that what her students need more than anything else is a firm hand. Listener discretion is advised for sensitive listeners and for those with small children.
I was really excited about teaching. I thought, like, I watched all these movies about teaching, like Dead Poets Society and Stand and Deliver, and the one with Michelle Pfeiffer, whose name escapes me now, but there's some rapping song about it. But I watched those movies, and I was like, okay, all I have to do is I walk through the students' desks in a certain kind of way, and I lean against my own desk in a right way, and then I'll just look like I'm in control. And if you look like you're in control, then in fact, you are in control. I got to this point where I really felt legitimately excited about the whole thing. But then the problem was, and this is classic behavior on my part, I undermined myself when at the first class I was like, oh, I know what I'll do. To look authoritative, I'm going to call myself professor. I was like, hey, everybody, I'm Sarah. I'll be your writing professor. It came to me in what I thought was like a moment of genius. But in fact, there was this one student whose name was Harry. And I don't mean to suggest that you can know a person as gay by looking at them. I don't think that you do. But I'm just saying there's a thing that he was doing with like color clashing that was very strong. And I was like, that's something that a gay man can do. Anyway, so Harry was like, excuse me, did you just call yourself professor? And I was like, I did. And he goes, right. Is this an accredited college or university? And I was like, no. And he's like, right. It's not. So you shouldn't call yourself professor. This is like adult continuing ed. So you should call yourself instructor. And I was kind of like, I'm going to cry / fair point. And that was as chummy as it got those first few weeks. Like, it was very awkward. We had to find some way to fill the time, and I felt the least I could do for my students who were getting cheated out of a class that they'd pay for was that I could at least leave it up to them in terms of what it was that we would do to fill the time. This is how it came to pass, in a very necessity is mother of invention type way, that we came up with a game that we called This Might Be Controversial. It came about in the workshop portion of the class. And I had this one student who was Swedish and lovely and spoke impeccable English. And his name was Sten. And Sten felt really uncomfortable saying anything negative. So he would say, like, I really like how on page 4, paragraph 9, it is wonderful when you do the scene where you're washing your feet and then crying. It's super duper funny. But as my improvement, oh, I don't know, instructor, I just think it's writing is so hard for people. So it is a good piece that Miriam has written. Now, mind you, Miriam was this recent retiree who I had, and it's her piece. What she'd submitted was the eulogy from her mother's funeral. She was like, one of, do you know there are those women, you always see them around and they wear like only the color purple, and you're like, oh, right, you're a little broken. She was one of those people, and I think that Sven intuited that about her and so therefore tried to be kind. But the problem was he would be kind to everybody, no matter what. And so I had to work very hard to get a harsher critique out of him. I'd say, listen, you have to find a way that works for you. And the way that Sven found that worked for him was by saying, this might be controversial. He offered it up as sort of like this disclaimer. So he'd say something like, this might be controversial, but on page 6, paragraph 10, I thought the line where you had 7 adjectives, this is very silly. It was kind of like for him, this might be controversial, freed him up and allowed him to say whatever he had to say, which was its own thing. But then what started happening is it got to this point where no one in the class would give a critique without setting it up with, this might be controversial. So you'd hear like, this might be controversial, but on page 1, paragraph 3, your interpretation of manic depression as creative genius, like for me, it's like it feels really self-delighted. So this is how it went, right? Always hearing this phrase. And then one day, maybe halfway through the class, Harry, who to remind you was the guy who was gay and had paired colors very well, he came back from a bathroom break and was like, all right, listen, here's my idea. The next time someone says, this might be controversial, the deal is you have to follow it up with something really controversial. What do you think? And frankly, I was like, whatever. Like anything that we can do to stretch this class out, let's bring it in. Harry, you go first. He said, great. This might be controversial, but I actually do not want them to legalize gay marriage. I hate marriage. I hate the weddings. I hate the registries. I hate the amount of money, the travel. It's like suddenly all my vacation time is spent like going to other people's stupid weddings. And I feel like the privilege of being gay was that I had to deal with less of that than everybody else. And he sighed when he was done. And I was like, excuse me, Harry, that sounded good. He was like, excuse me, but it felt good. And you could feel from the other students in the room, not judgment, okay? It wasn't that anybody had been offended. It was rather this sort of like desire creeping out, this sense that the other students wanted their own catharsis. This might be controversial, but I wish divorce on most of my friends. This might be controversial, but I hated The Wire. And then I had this other student who was like, all right, listen to this. This might be controversial, but I saw this thing on the news the other day about this family, okay? And I know it's horrible. They had 10 kids, and one of the kids drowned in a river. Horrible. But the parents are there, and they're going on, and they're sobbing, and they're yammering, and it's all about like how it's the city's fault, and the city didn't have a fence up, and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, you guys, you still have 9 more kids. And no one said that it made sense, but the point is, we tried to provide a safe environment for something like that to be articulated. And this is how it would go, right? And the only rule in place was that you could not say something if you didn't believe it, which, to be frank, was not a problem. I had this other student named Dave. Now, a few words on Dave. Dave was Caucasian. He had dreadlocks. He had very wealthy parents. And what I thought of as being sort of an allergy to any and all critiques of his writing. And one day we're in the midst of playing our game and he goes, all right, well, this might be controversial, but I don't think bestiality is that gross. Like, I'm just saying, man, like, I kind of get it. And at that point, all of us nodded in acceptance. Not agreement, but acceptance. So there's this one day where Sven comes to class and he's looking atypically upset. And Miriam's like, oh, Sven, what's wrong? And Sven's like, well, I have something very controversial to say and I'm very ashamed by this one. Oh, this might be controversial, but when I think about the politician, that is John Edwards, I do not blame him for his cheating because his wife is so homely. And Miriam heard this and she was like, what? Sven, not is, was. Elizabeth Edwards has died. And then Dave was like, Miriam, chill. Sven's just being controversial. Don't make him feel bad. He knows it's bad. Just like, look how sad he looks. And Miriam was like, Sven, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be cruel. I mean, we all have our things, you know. For what it's worth, this might be controversial, but I only go to male doctors because I have a problem trusting women. This writing class, in total, ran for 10 weeks. When finally we reached that last week, something very bizarre and unprecedented happened, which is that we wound up not playing. This might be controversial. It was almost as though we reached a sort of saturation point and we lost the will to speak on controversial subjects. But what was even weirder than that was that we didn't need to speak on controversial subjects because for the first and only time since the class had started, my students cared about my lecture because the topic was the business of writing. And when I announced it to them, when I was like, all right, everyone, it's time for us to talk about how to make money. Suddenly it's like they're scribbling in their notebooks. Everybody has questions. They're like, am I going to get published? How often? How much money am I going to make? And it was the only moment as a teacher that felt to me like the teachers in the movies that I'd seen. Do you know what I mean? There was like some sense of like, everybody, calm down. Hold on. I'm going to get there when I get there. I said, you guys, listen up. You might get published, but only online, and you will never make any money. And they're like, any money? And I was like, well, no, I mean, you can make some money, but not the kind that's going to do you any good. And then I had this one student raise her hand, and she was like, wait a second. Is this why you pack a homemade tuna sandwich every week? And I was like, exactly. She was like, is this why your clothes are always stained because it's too expensive to dry clean them? I was like, exactly. They'd done so much growing in the weeks that I'd had them. Maybe, you know, maybe their writing hadn't gotten much better, but certainly they were learning to read people and judge character. And I said, wow, you guys, you have learned so much. And the second the words were out of my mouth, I catch them eyeing one another. And Harry shook his head and raised his hand and said, I'm not so sure about that. I think that opinion might be controversial.
Big thanks to Sarah Barron. This story came from the Risk Podcast, and thanks as well to Kevin Allison and all the folks at Risk. If you want to hear this piece, uncut, raw, and uncensored, head on over to the Risk Podcast. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. When Snap returns, one little girl puts her daddy to the test. How does he do? With Snap Judgment, the B Team continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the B Team, where we explore exactly what happens when Plan A falls apart. Our next story occurs within the confines of a tight, loving family. Loving. But when our next guest was a child, her father could be a little strict. Snap Judgment.
He was strict pretty much in everything, from the clothes we wore and the friends we had. When we had church, if it was 3 times a week, we had to be there 3 times a week. He had to have things a certain way. The other thing that drove me crazy about my dad is the way that he disapproved of all of my boyfriends, of all of the guys that I ever dated, consistently. One guy he didn't like me dating because he wasn't religious. One time my dad didn't like someone because he drove a red Corvette. And I remember one time I was trying to go meet this guy, and my dad, as I was running out the door, took my house keys from me and just like went in the house so that I couldn't leave. And I have a very free personality. And so we would argue, and he never budged. But then one day, my church threw a cotillion. And I mean, we had the gowns, and the boys were in suits, and it was really, really fancy for us. And one of the guys there was very cute. And that's the first thing I noticed about him, is that he was very cute. And about 15 minutes later, he walks over to me and he asks me to dance. And it's so funny because he asked me, and I could see my dad out of the corner of my eye, and I'm like, oh God. But I was like, okay, so we danced, you know, to this song, and he smelled really good. And I like good smelling things. We didn't talk. We were silent the whole time that we were dancing, but it was just kind of like, strangely, a very comfortable feeling. Because, you know, sometimes when you meet people and you're attracted to them, there's like these nerves and then you step on each other's feet. That didn't happen. It was just kind of like we had met before. And it was just a very intense but innocent moment. And I could just, it was great. So the guy's name was Dwayne. And about 3 weeks later, he called me. And it's just, like, we had this great conversation. And they never stopped. We had a conversation that night. And the next day, we had a conversation. And from then on, it was just kind of a whirlwind teenage romance. He was the first boy to ever make me feel love by listening to me and understanding who I was, and then acting on that. And there were reasons why I didn't feel worthy of that love. We were from vastly different sides of the track. My parents were low income. We lived in the city of Eastside, not even the better parts. And he came from a completely opposite background. You know, when you go into Dwayne's parents' house, there's statues, the maid has come and washed all the dishes, and it was, a four-bedroom, three-bathroom house in the suburbs. But to me, that was a castle. And so I'm like, okay, you should love a princess. Like, why are you loving me? It's so weird. What are you doing? It never mattered to him. You know, because I sometimes would bring it up. I'm like, oh, you know, you shouldn't drive all the way over here at night. And he's just like, who cares? This is where you are, so this is where I want to be. It didn't even make him flinch. It's just like, you shouldn't love me. But you do, and I don't understand why, but that is so major. And the most surprising part about all of this is that my dad adored him. He sat me down and he was like, I really like Dwayne. He's, you know, into the church and he's surrounded with good people. And he was actually in an engineering program. And my dad has a degree in electrical engineering. So yeah, they would sit in the living room and talk. It's just so weird. But it's a fairy tale. You don't think the perfect guy exists. You know, you hear about it and it's like, oh, that's nice. But he was. And if this was what love was, this is what I wanted forever. But then one day, about a year later, and this is, it kind of gets unusual here because I woke up that morning and I woke up naturally, which is the first sign that something is wrong because my mom always wakes me up early on Saturday so that I can clean the bathroom. And that didn't happen. I just woke up. So almost like she could sense I woke up. She just kind of like opened the door and she said, you know, can you come downstairs? So I turned the corner and she's sitting on the bed with her TV off, which is also unusual. And like when I looked at her face, I immediately knew that he was dead. Immediately. Like, I just knew that something was seriously wrong. And the only person that I loved as much as Dwayne was Dwayne. And I just needed to hear her say the words. And she said, you know, Dwayne's mom called. Dwayne died last night. He was playing basketball, and his friends say that he had caught the ball and he was dribbling down the court, and all of a sudden he just stopped and he collapsed. and it was from a small hole in his heart that no one had ever known was there. And so everybody just ran over to him. And by the time they got to him, he was already gone. And I just kind of, I didn't react. How do you react to that? I just stared at my reflection in the mirror. And so she said, "Are you okay?" And I didn't answer her. And she said, "Well, do you want to go to your room?" And I said, "Yeah." And as soon as I got in my room, I just started crying. Because we were supposed to go to the movies, you know? We were supposed to be at Blade that night. And like, it took days for me to understand that he was not gonna call me. You know, that he wasn't gonna instant message me, that he wasn't gonna page me. Because you just want that feeling back. Like, especially when it's taken away from you without notice, you just want it back. Almost immediately after it happened, I started to collect everything I could find that had his name on it, about him, about his death. If someone's saying something on the radio, I would record it as fast as I could. I had like my recorder on standby, and I just kind of cleared off an area on my dresser, and I just stacked everything up there, and no one could touch it. If anyone came in my room, they knew not to go near the Duane Memorial, because it was very important to me. I went from an honor roll student to I was getting like C's and D's and everything. I just couldn't concentrate. I couldn't focus. I didn't want to date because I firmly believed there was no other Duane. And aside from that portion of it, I didn't want to date people because I was afraid they would die. And so I felt like the more people I could cut off and exclude from my life, the better off I would be because I wouldn't have to love them and I wouldn't have to lose them. But then one day, when I was older, I was home by myself. My parents were both at work, and I went looking for a vinyl record that I knew that my dad had in the basement. And I definitely knew that I had to be careful because the basement was my dad's sanctuary. He kept everything that was really important to him down there. And we knew as children that if it was in Dad's basement, it wasn't to be taken out of the basement or messed with, you know, leave these things alone. But then I noticed a newspaper. And the reason the newspaper stuck out to me is because it was starting to yellow. And it was underneath some things, almost like it was being hidden. So I got curious. And on the cover of the newspaper, it said, Duane Cockrum. And then it had a page number where the rest of the story was. And so now I'm thinking, I haven't seen this newspaper before. I turn to the page and it starts out with how he died and how wonderful he was. And then it starts to describe his girlfriend and how she was dealing with the loss of the love of her life. And it said her name was Pamela. And my name is not Pamela. And so my fantasy, I think, my dreams about what he was were really crushed. He was cheating on me. And there's no chance that it's a mistake because the city that she lived in, it wasn't Cleveland, it was the suburb that he lived in. So she was one of him. I was from this other side of the track, and she was from his. And so there was no confusion on the writer's part. He had two girlfriends. But then the second thing I realized is that, like, my dad had this newspaper all this time, and he had concealed this from me. Because I think he knew that knowing the truth at the same time that I was grieving would have been devastating for me. And I don't know at what cost and how long, I guess forever, you know, he was willing to keep this from me, to spare my heart. But, you know, that's love. So I just, you know, put it back. And he got home and I didn't act any differently. It's kind of of strange. It's just like kind of circular. I so fiercely wanted to protect my dad's effort, you know, to keep this secret. And so I wanted him to continue existing in a space where he believed that the knowledge of good and evil was far from me. And I didn't want him to feel like he lost that battle. So, you know, he came in, we worked on homework and talked, and that was it. But shortly after, I took the Duane memorial down. And I'm sure if I was to check in the basement, the newspaper would be still there, right where it was. I have never told him that I know. He still doesn't know that I know.
Hello.
Many thanks to Beverly Gooden for sharing her story with Snap. Today, Beverly is a writer and human resource manager in North Carolina. And if you want to learn more about her, check out our website, snapjudgment.org. We'll have a link. And when Snap Judgment returns, we've got a softball team full of little girls that will strike terror into the hearts of grown men. For real. On Snap Judgment, the B-Team episode continues. Stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're exploring what happens when the best laid plans of mice and men go awry. Now, some people, they just throw in the towel, call it a day, but not the people on our show. Tara Clancy, she was one tough 11-year-old. But when she was not 11 years old, she told this story in front of a live audience in New York City. Take it away, Tara.
Hi, how's everybody doing? You all right? Okay. All right, here we go. It's the last inning of the game. We are down by one, two outs, no men on, no men anywhere. We are 11-year-old girls. We are playing softball. All right, so I'm in the dugout, right? And I am like nervous as hell. You know, I'm like writhing my little girl hands and I'm pacing back and forth. And I'm watching as Michelle, who is the best player on our team, is making her way towards the plate. All right, now, because this is the Catholic Youth Organization League, we are not called like, you know, the such and such Tomcats or the such and such Bulldogs. We are just St. Gregory the Great. period. In this game, we are playing our biggest rivals who are called, I get this, Immaculate Conception. As in, it is us versus the greatest freaking miracle of all time. Got a prayer, you know. So Michelle is like, you know, she is like hopping on the balls of her feet and she's, you know, helicoptering the bat over her head. You know, she is approaching the plate like this is, you know, the World Series. This is not Yankee Stadium. This is not even a baseball field. This is basically a parking lot. It is a blacktop schoolyard field way, way out in Queens. And we play here for no other reason than we are girls. really. All of the boys in the CYO play on dirt, and all of the girls play on asphalt. And this is just how it is. This is how it has always been. And we are young, but we are not too young to realize, you know, that this is some serious All right. So now Michelle is like continues making her way up towards the plate. And the last thing she does is she stops and she turns and she looks like at the handful of dads that hang out behind the backstop. Now, most of our fathers were like, you know, cops and construction workers during the week. But come Saturday, they were our coaches and our cheerleaders, you know, like minus the pom-poms, right? Instead of that, they scream things at us like, you know, hey, you know, you just gonna look at that ball, or you gonna take a swing sometime this year, sweetheart, you know? Or they're like, you know, atta girl, you drive that ball right through them, you know? Now, my father comes to every single game, but Michelle's does not. And so all of a sudden, I see her kind of stop and shock on her face, because there he is, her dad. Now, he was actually like a sweetheart of a guy, but a serious alcoholic. She sees him and her face lights up and he smiles and he does the old, you can do it fist pump. And that's all it takes. Michelle turns, she stamps into the box, she proceeds to smack the very first pitch into left field for a double. Now Michelle's on second base, and the pitcher goes to wind up, and Michelle takes off to steal third, and she is like half the way there when the catcher takes the ball, wings it to the third baseman, and it should be game over. But then, Michelle does something that nobody there that day, nobody on either team, had ever seen done before. She slides on asphalt. And it is like the earth stops spinning, right? I mean, it is like the clouds freeze in the sky and time stops and every single person in attendance goes, and now the third baseman is standing there and she's got the ball and she's got it way up here. Like she's just not even moving. Like she's in total shock. She doesn't even like practically look down to tag her, right? And still it's going, you know, right? And now Michelle is down there and she writhes on the ground finally. And now like we know she's alive, but it still goes, you know. And finally the umpire, who is just like gobsmacked, runs out and he's like, safe? And whoosh, right? We go off the rails. I jump from the ground up into the chain link fence, like Spider-Man style, right? And I'm like 5 feet in the air. I got my fingers through the chain link. I am shaking this thing. I'm like, yeah! Meanwhile, now, all the girls on their team on the field literally just start taking off their gloves and, like, throwing it to the ground, you know, and they're like, you can't do that. You can't do that. And all the moms also come out and like, you can't do that, right? Somebody's dad shows up and he's like, you know, that's disgusting. Who would tell a young girl to slide in the concrete, you know? Somebody's grandmother even says, God will punish you for this. Finally, the umps and the coaches and everybody comes out and they meet, you know, out on the mound and powwow and debate and whatever. And ultimately, they decide that, you know, turns out there is no written rule against sliding on asphalt. So the call stays. But, you know, the practice is like officially deemed, you know, a pretty stupid idea. And we get some about, you know, like never doing it again. Now, it turns out, right, sliding on asphalt doesn't really involve much sliding, right? Like, you know, pretty much if you do it absolutely perfectly, you rip out the entire seat of your pants as you go and only the first layer of skin. done wrong, you know, you need like upwards of a dozen stitches, you know, and either way, you get a bruise the size of Connecticut. But either way, no matter how you do it, it works every single time because nobody expects you to be stupid enough to try, right? And I know that for a fact because following this game, pretty much every single girl on my team would go on to do it. In fact, like, we couldn't wait, you know? Like, you know how, like, Girl Scouts, like, collect those little triangle patches for, like, accomplishments, you know, like, kite making or something, and there's a little picture of a kite on it, right? Okay, like, this was me. I wanted a patch, you know? I wanted a patch with a little bloody leg on it, you know? The next game comes around, and we are like, we're just out of our minds. Like, literally, anytime one of us get, if we just get on base, right, all the rest of us just start, you know, just start cheering. You know, we're like, do it, do it, do it. It's like, you're not at church league softball anymore. You're like at a cage fight, man. It's like MMA. We're like, ah! We're like taking tin cans and squashing them into our foreheads, you know? And I'm like dying. I cannot wait for my chance, right? And so finally, here it is. I am on second base. Somebody whacks one out into right field. I start running for third. The third base coach is like holding me off. I'm like, hell no. I round the base. I'm heading for home, right? I got my head down. I'm in like this full-on sprint, you know, and I get like a couple steps, you know, away from home plate, and I just look up and I watch as the catcher catches the ball, right? I'm done for. But I'm like, screw it. I jump up into the air. I literally dive over the catcher head first, full on swan dive. And then I come down head first. Bang, blackout. When I come to, my father is standing there over me, and he is like waving, you know, two fingers in front of my face, and he's got like, you know, steam is coming out of his ears, and but I've got like this big smile, you know, and I'm like, so? And he's like, well, you know, look, I think it's probably only, you know, like a mild concussion, you know? And I'm like, no, 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 so? And he's like, what? Oh, for Pete's sake, you know, he's like, you're safe. You were safe, you jerk. This is a little postscript. Turns out, this year, it is now 23 years later, so it took 23 years. This year, 23 years later, for the first time ever, the CYO finally righted this wrong, and just this past softball season, all the little girls in Brooklyn and Queens played on dirt. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tara, for telling your story on The Snap. If you want to hear more stories like this one, check out the storytelling series Sideshow Goshko. We'll have a link to all of their info and also a link to Tara's homepage on our website, snapjudgment.org. Yes, you've reached the end of the episode, but not the end of the journey. Now, this is Snap Judgment Storytelling at snapjudgment.org. Don't be the kind of person that wants something, that lives a tragic life, unable to bring the desire to fruition. Just subscribe to the Snap Judgment Podcast because hours of storytelling goodness awaits. And you're the type of person that gets what they want. Life lesson. Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and the funkiest team ever to crash into a deserted island. Please say hello to Gilligan himself, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. The Skipper, Pat Mesiti Miller, Anna Thurston Sussman Howell III, Julia Lovey DeWitt, Nancy the movie star Lopez, Joe
the Professor Rosenberg, Renzo the Pilot Goryeo, the bank robbers with the boat who took off in the middle of the night, leaving everybody stranded, Liza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, and Aurora Soria. Also, Jasmine Marianne Aguilera. If you've ever done one of those dating apps and set up an appointment with someone who doesn't quite look like their picture, well, that's kind of like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Beyonce? I don't think so. But much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, doesn't have a plan B because they're bad to the bone with plan A. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago, kind of like WKRP in Cincinnati, but in Chicago. And as you may have heard, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you take a basketball down to the local bowling alley, dribble down the lane, kick over all the pins, yell touchdown, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.